This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Some AI-powered dating apps can predict who you might find attractive. Others help build your profile or suggest conversation starters. So are they the future of love, or are they just a bit creepy? I'm Hannah Gelbart. We're diving into how these apps work and how they differ from traditional dating apps. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We go in-depth on a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. US President Donald Trump has repeatedly said he's convinced his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin wants peace in Ukraine. But major drone and missile strikes on Donetsk and Kharkiv, as elsewhere last night, suggest otherwise. At least 20 people have been killed and dozens more injured. It seems mostly civilians. A spokesperson for the Donetsk Police Service gave more details of the attack there.
This is an ordinary residential building. There were people inside. Several entrances were completely burnt out, and this is just one of the damaged buildings. The others also suffered significant damage. Windows were smashed. Vehicles that were parked near the site of the shelling were damaged.
Well, earlier this week, President Trump announced he was suspending all military aid to Ukraine with immediate effect. A couple of days later, it was announced that the US would no longer share intelligence with Ukraine, and it's thought would also ban other allies, such as the UK, from sharing US intelligence with Ukraine. Now the Trump administration has limited Ukraine's access to commercial satellite imagery. The American firm Maxar has been helping Ukrainian soldiers to see real-time images of the battlefield, which has allowed them to track Russian troop movements and supply lines, amongst other things. In a statement, Maxar said it was blocking access to Ukraine in line with US President Donald Trump's wishes. And a couple of hours ago, I spoke to Major Volodymyr Omelyan. He's a former Ukrainian Minister of Infrastructure, but is now serving on the front line. And I asked him how useful satellite imagery has been in the defence of his country.
It played a significant role. Because using this intelligence, using satellites, we are able to foresee Russian Red Army actions, to understand what kind of supplies they provide to the front line, to understand what kind of attacks they already doing. By cutting that, we become almost blind. We still have some access to our own surveillance, but it's mainly short, mid-range. You cannot prevail or you cannot destroy the enemy if you don't understand its actions.
Okay, so we understand that this commercial access has been denied very recently, in the past day or so. Has it already had an impact on soldiers on the front line?
For the front line, it's not that visible because we operate mainly with the short-range surveillance, which is gathered by our own sources. But for the long-range strikes, yes, it has the impact. Mm. And if we do not destroy targets inside of Russia, it means that supplies of fresh meat, supplies of artillery, ammunition will be getting to the front line.
And in terms of the fighting on the front line at the moment, do you have an update on the situation? Because we obviously heard last night there were lots of drone strikes. It seems many on civilian areas, but we're also hearing that the Russians are making advances in the Kursk region, which Ukrainian soldiers had taken, and we understand there could be a group of Ukrainian soldiers now pretty much surrounded by Russian troops there.
Red Army was really exhausted, and within last weeks it was visible for everybody. The intensity of their attacks was down. But I believe that they were inspired by recent news from Washington, and last couple of days they do not care what are the targets. They simply try to make it ground zero.
Major, the narrative coming from the White House has been recently that Ukraine can't win this war, that Russia has, to quote Mr. Trump, all the cards, and Ukraine doesn't have the cards. You've actually been fighting the Russians for some time on the front line. Can they be defeated?
Absolutely, yes. Concerning the Red Army, it's visible that all their plans are destroyed. We are fighting one of the largest armies in the world for years, and they can do nothing with us.
And I'm sure you're aware of this showdown that happened about a week ago in the Oval Office, with your president, Volodymyr Zelensky, being, well, basically lambasted by Mr. Trump and also Vice President J.D. Vance. I don't know whether you've seen the clips or what soldiers think about that, and also the changes to the intelligence sharing and the freeze on U.S. weaponry. How's that affected the morale of your troops?
We all were shocked because we relied on the United States as our biggest supporter and ally, and we still do so. Therefore, this picture from Oval Office last week, it was a kind of very bad discovery for all of us. I wouldn't say that we only blame Trump for that. We understand the mood of his team, but still, I believe that democratic values will remain and prevail in the United States. There are too many emotions. Sometimes it doesn't really matter who is publicly wrong or right. What really matters, what kind of results you get, what kind of supplies you have, and what kind of support you are provided.
You're a politician, actually, in normal life, aren't you? You're a former Minister of Infrastructure, and we've just caught you as you head back to the front line. I don't know how long you'll be there for, but, I mean, in terms of the fatigue and the will to keep fighting, how are Ukrainians who are doing that feeling about the prospect of a continuing war?
We are not naturally born killers, and definitely we are all fatigued with the war, but there is no other option for us on the table. We either win or we lose. If Ukraine is supplied with the weapons and Russian army is destroyed, Kremlin will be in Washington next minute and will sign any kind of document. I think that the war will be over only when Kremlin is destroyed, because Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Russia will do the same.
Major Volodymyr Omelyan there, speaking to us on the road back to the front line. So what do we know of this commercial satellite company, Maxar? It's been told by President Trump to deny Ukraine access to its services, but as a privately owned company, does Mr. Trump actually have the power to influence its decisions? I've been speaking to Stepan Stepanenko, who's a military policy analyst.
It's an American firm that runs a series of satellites and takes essentially photos of what is happening on the ground. Now, in terms of allowing to share this information with other countries, the American government can stop Maxar selling any information, any intelligence to any other nation.
And is this because they obviously would have had to sign official secrets acts and that sort of thing, and they're tied into a specific sort of contract, really, with the government?
There's also a series of laws that regulate the defense sector and allow or don't allow certain actions to make sure that the know-how, the intelligence and the technical expertise don't go to the wrong hands. But in this case, they're doing the opposite.
And briefly, obviously, this is the latest of the restrictions on Ukraine. It comes after the US also stopped sharing its intelligence with Ukraine, which has been so crucial throughout this war. What do you think the impact of that will be in real terms on the soldiers on the front line?
The main thing for them is this kind of stab in the back is not going to be liked by them. But Ukrainians are fighting for their land and for their very existence. So it's not going to deter them from fighting, because they know what's going to happen if they give up.
In terms of intelligence sharing, it's been one of the most effective ways that allied nations, those that are part of the Five Eyes alliance, but also part of NATO, have sort of united militarily and in defensive terms over decades, isn't it? What does this change that we're seeing from the White House, what does it mean for both those organizations?
At the moment, we have to toe the American line, and we have to come to terms with that.
I wonder particularly that we hear from President Trump that he's had several phone calls with Mr. Putin. Will countries like the UK and Canada be worried about sharing in intelligence if there's a risk that something might be inadvertently said or let slip?
Well, within Five Eyes operations, Britain, for example, can prevent any further intelligence sharing by stepping out of the Five Eyes, but while we're in it, we'll have to do it. What is interesting in this regard is Trump's earlier decision to ease the cyber warfare operations and cyber defense against Russia. The primary target for Russian hackers has been economic infrastructure. And if you decrease the level of security, then you're putting everyone's livelihood in danger.
Military analyst Stepan Stepanenko there. Well, meanwhile, here in the UK on Friday, three Bulgarian nationals were found guilty of spying for Russia in what police have described as one of the largest foreign intelligence operations in the United Kingdom. One of those targeted by the Bulgarian spies was the Russian journalist Raman Dobrohotov. He's believed that he and his fellow investigative journalist, the Bulgarian Christo Grozev, were targeted because of their exposés on Russian poisonings. Mr. Dobrohotov believes that the plan was to kill him, and he's been speaking to the BBC's Daniel De Simone.
I'm very lucky to be alive, actually. I think assassination was one of the options that they reviewed. But even if it was kidnapping, that doesn't mean that I was just, you know, brought to Russia and then let free. It was about interrogating and then killing.
So when was the first time that the police came and told you what was going on?
So I think it was January 2023. The risk was that me and Krista would be killed. And the fact that the spies were very clumsy doesn't mean anything because, you know, in case of Skripal poisoning, they also did all the possible mistakes and behaved in a very stupid way. But they still poisoned Skripal and his daughter. They murdered and UK citizen. So the fact that they're very, very unprofessional, very clumsy, very stupid, still doesn't mean that they are not dangerous.
Who ordered that you should be targeted?
I think that it was Vladimir Putin directly. In this dictatorship, you would never take responsibility on your own to do such a political stuff. You will always have direct order from the president. It doesn't have to be a written order. It can be something said orally, but that will be always an order from above.
And do you have a particular message for Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin doesn't understand messages in words, only in actions. So he understands messages like, for example, Ukraine got long-range missiles. That's a message that he can understand. And when his spies are arrested and imprisoned for a big sentence, that's also a message that he can understand. This is actually something that motivates us to work. That's why we want to change Russia, because this is not the country we want to live in ourselves and our children to live in, the country that kills people just because they're doing journalism or because they are criticizing the government. So now, yeah, we're in a situation that only some of us will survive. Either we or Vladimir Putin and his team.
Raman Dobrohotov there, speaking to the BBC's Daniel De Simone. Still to come in the programme, why one Danish veteran is so aggrieved by President Trump's desire to take Greenland from Denmark that he's taken down a treasured military memento.
I was awarded a Bronze Star by the United States, and I got the Stars and Stripes. But after the president's disrespect for internationally acknowledged borders, I took that Stars and Stripes down.
More on that story to come later this hour, and our headlines this hour from the newsroom. South Korea's impeached president, Sun Yuk-sul, has been freed after nearly 2 months in detention that followed his failed declaration of martial law. And the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo has offered a $5 million reward for information that would help them catch Rwandan-backed rebel leaders in the east. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Neuroscientists working with survivors from Israel's Nova Festival after the 7th of October Hamas attacks say there are early signs that MDMA or ecstasy might have provided some psychological protection from trauma. Preliminary findings from a large-scale study being carried out at Israel's Haifa University suggest that the illegal drug, which induces pro-social hormones like oxytocin in the brain, was associated with better mental health outcomes among survivors from that festival. It's thought to be one of the first times scientists have been able to study a mass trauma event where large numbers of people were under the influence of mind-altering drugs. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has this report now from Jerusalem.
Moments before Hamas gunmen attacked, thousands of people were dancing at the Nova Festival near the Gaza border. The stories of what happened to their lives, their friends, their bodies, have largely come to light. Now scientists are looking at what was happening to their brains. Many of those dancing at sunrise were high on illegal drugs like MDMA and LSD. One of them was Mihal Ohana.
On October 7, I take MDMA. And today, I know this has helped me.
Mihal now believes the drug helped save her life, preventing her from freezing in fear.
I feel like this has saved my life because I was in so high, and I feel like not in this real world. If I didn't take, I stop and I sit on the floor and take me or kill me.
Despite feeling detached from reality at the time, Mihal is still struggling to return to normal life.
I wake up with this and I go sleep with this. And people don't understand. We live this day, every day.
Researchers say there's no hard evidence that drugs helped people like Mihal escape the attacks. But Roy Salomon, leading the research on more than 600 Nova survivors, says initial results suggest MDMA in particular could have helped protect them against the effects of trauma.
People that were on MDMA during the attack, they were sleeping better, they were experiencing less mental distress than other people. MDMA was, in one sense, it had a protective effect. That means they were actually doing better than people who did not take any substance. Even during the event itself, they were somewhat protected by the fact that there was a reduction of negative affect. So even within this terrible situation, they were able to see the love of their friends, the camaraderie they had within escaping with other people. And then when they got home, they were open to receive the love and care of their families and friends. And this is key.
So right now you're in a therapy room for MDMA, mood lighting, candles, even a bed that we can open up for the treatment. But when you zoom out and you look around us, you'll notice signs that we're actually also in a bomb shelter. We have an air filtration system. You'll notice the thick door, the windows that have the metal shutters. We're set up.
MDMA is already being explored as an experimental treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, and this study is fueling growing interest from scientists in its potential use. Anna Harwood-Gross, Director of Research at Israel's Metiv Psychotrauma Center, says the early results from the Nova research also helped to answer concerns about using it in countries with a high risk of attacks or sirens occurring during treatment.
They've talked about using MDMA in Ukraine. They've talked about using psychedelics in Rwanda. They're questioning, you know, can we use psychedelics in an environment which is not safe? MDMA opens up a lot of potential, but it also makes you vulnerable. You're very vulnerable to everything that's going on around you. And I think that we've learned that if we create the right framework, despite the fact that we're still a country at war, we're able to do this psychedelic treatment.
The Nova Festival site today is home to many memories of pain and heroism, hundreds of memorials for the dead, and perhaps lessons for the world in surviving trauma from those still struggling to live.
Lucy Williamson with that report. Now, Now, it seems the police in Santa Fe have worked out the tragic set of circumstances that led to the deaths of Hollywood star Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy Arakawa. The New Mexico investigators say they died of natural causes. It's thought Betsy died first of hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, HPS, which is a respiratory illness caused by exposure to infected rodents. Mr. Hackman, who was 95 and had a range of health problems, including advanced Alzheimer's disease, died about a week later. So what do we know of this HPS disease? How dangerous is it? Let's speak to Olli Vapalahti now, who's professor of virology at the University of Helsinki in Finland. He joins us live. So first of all, what do we know of this disease and its symptoms? How dangerous is it?
Hello. So hantavirus pulmonary syndrome is indeed a severe form of this rodent-borne hantavirus infection that is only present in Americas, not in the old world, that after unspecific initial symptoms, it especially affects the lungs with lung, the syndrome is related to that the blood vessels leak so that the liquid in a way fills the airspace in the lungs and with difficulties in breathing.
Right. And how do you catch it? Is it fairly easy to catch?
In those areas where there's abundance of this specific carrier rodent, it usually happens indoors. The virus and the aerosols are dispersed and inactivated by sunshine. So inside, indoors, in barns, woodsheds, cottages, wherever, then rodents may be abundant and rodent droppings, fresh rodent droppings present.
So you may not actually know that you've contracted it. What are the early symptoms, and is there any treatment or how what should you do if you think you may have been exposed to it?
Fortunately, first of all, it's rare. There is no specific treatment as yet. So there are two kinds of diseases. In Americas, we have the pulmonary syndrome. If you get these severe symptoms, you really need intensive care or very specific treatment in hospitals. In the old world, you have a renal syndrome you also may need hospital care, but it's only maybe 10% that die, whereas this American and in Europe we have a milder disease where it's just some per mil, whereas this American disease, the mortality is around 30-40%.
Right. Oh dear, that's very high. So, I mean, I guess as it's a virus, there aren't any antibiotics, but are treatments being developed briefly to try to mitigate this?
Yes, there are treatments in development, as well as there are vaccines in development, but partially due to the fact that this is still a rare disease in many places, so this has not been perhaps a great urge for the companies. But there is actually a vaccine that is used in Korea, and also there's a vaccine used to millions in China.
Okay.
but not in the West.
All right, still in development. Olli Vapalahti, thank you very much for joining us live on that story.
Some AI-powered dating apps can predict who you might find attractive. Others help build your profile or suggest conversation starters. So are they the future of love, or are they just a bit creepy? I'm Hannah Gelbart. We're diving into how these apps work and how they differ from traditional dating apps. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We go in-depth on a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In the African island nation of Madagascar, a group of grandmothers are helping to bring electricity to their families and villages. They're being trained to install solar panels in remote areas, and grannies have been chosen for the project because they were thought to be most likely to return and stay in those villages after learning the new skills. Sarah Tirij has the story.
Mobile sarsim.
Mobile sarsim.
This is a classroom full of grandmothers who are learning how to install lamps and solar panels. Most of the women never went to school or know how to read or write, but soon they will bring electricity to their villages. These classes are run by the World Wildlife Fund and an international NGO called Barefoot College, which trains communities worldwide to be self-sufficient. Nearly 100 women have been trained here to install and fix solar panels, but they also learn about women's and children's rights, micro-entrepreneurship and health.
Before the training, I didn't have a real job, but now I know how to spell my name. I learned how to read or write other words as well. That's really changed my life. When I came back from the training center, the other women admired me, and I've become an inspiration for them.
At 43, Mom has four children and two grandchildren. I visit her at home in Kivalu while she's peeling vegetables for dinner. The fishing village can only be reached with small wooden boats. Like most villages in Madagascar, it's very far off from the electricity grid.
So Mom is now installing a small solar panel on the top of a wooden hut. She can't climb up there herself, so she's instructing all the boys and men around her. And she knows exactly what she's doing.
Before the WWF and the Barefoot College started training grandmothers in this village, people used petrol lamps, candles and torches to have at least a little bit of light after the sun sets. One family would easily burn through 30 batteries a month. That's expensive and creates a lot of waste. But that wasn't the only harm to the environment.
People are now cutting fewer trees because we get our light from solar panels. Before, we often made fires to have enough light to prepare fish for dinner. The sun is shining all year round, even during the rainy season, so using solar panels is really good for us.
Mom's neighbor, Nivo, a teacher, received a solar panel in May. It can only charge phones and small electronic devices. Yet for this family, having a reliable power source has been life-changing, Nivu tells me as she's preparing dinner for her family.
My daughter goes to school, and now she has enough light to study after class. And we can now eat without worrying about insects in our food or things like that. It makes my work easier, too. I can prepare classes in the evenings. It's really changed a lot for us.
That report by Sarah Tirij there on the electric specialist grannies in Madagascar there. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's get more information now on that story from Syria, that Syrian security forces are alleged to have killed dozens of people belonging to the minority Alawite community in the western coastal province of Latakia. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says many were summarily executed on Friday, including women and children. And there's also been reports of fighting between security forces and armed men loyal to the ousted President Bashar al-Assad. Let's get the latest live from the BBC's Lina Sinjab. She's in the capital, Damascus. Lina, thanks so much for coming on. First, just remind us what's been going on and why. What do we know about the fighting, first of all, between these two forces?
Well, it all broke out on Thursday when the security forces were trying to look for remnants of the Assad regime, but they've been ambushed by those armed men who are supporters of Assad regime. And, you know, the reports suggest that at least 50 of them were killed in several ambushes. This is something that called for, you know, more support coming from the security forces from across the country. But of course, among them, there were some groups who apparently are not you know, adhering to the messages coming from the top command of, you know, restoring order and not to commit violations. Many of them have all committed, you know, mass killing, especially in the city of Banias and some other villages around it. All these areas have, you know, majority of Alawite community and not necessarily supporters of Bashar al-Assad. During the attempt to find remnants of Assad, who are calling for revolt against the new leadership, who are calling for you know, attacks on this new leadership, many civilians have been killed in what appears to be revenge killing and mass shooting that included women and children.
And what has the new government had to say about this? Because they had been promising to protect minority groups like the Alawites.
Well, the interim president, Ahmed al-Shara, came out late last night to address the nation, on the one hand, praising the security and armed forces, who also lost, you know, dozens of their fighters, in these battles, but also stressing that he's, you know, pledging that there won't be any, unorganized, you know, arms between, the remnants of Assad regime. He called on them to hand over their weapons and, be brought to justice. But he also mentioned that those who are committing any violations against civilians will be brought to justice. Now, today, there are many messages coming from sources within the government or from journalists who are close to this new government, you know, admitting that there are some factions that are, you know, committing, you know, these kind of mass killings and that they will be brought to justice and that they will be stopped. But unfortunately, the situation is still tense and volatile, and there are still some killing happening. As we're talking right now, perhaps today, the situation is still, you know, tense in many towns and villages in the coastal sides.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that latest update there from Syria. That's the BBC's Lina Sinjab in the capital, Damascus. Well, earlier today, I spoke to a woman who is from Latakia. She's Alawite, but no longer lives in Syria. She's been in touch with family and friends there, though, and gave us her understanding of the situation there. Because of the fear in the Alawite community, she didn't want us to use her name or even her voice. So my colleague has voiced up her comments, and I asked her what she'd been hearing.
So as far as I was told by everybody, from family and friends on the ground in Latakia and Tartu City, there was a military campaign to look out for Assad supporters or followers who've been trying to commit sort of acts on the ground. And as a result, that campaign turned into a form of ethnic cleansing against Alawites in those two cities. The pictures, the videos are horrifying. One of my friends is a pharmacist whose husband was killed yesterday. And today she was shot as well while pregnant, and she's bleeding on the streets. People are in their houses, staying safe in their houses. They're not doing anything. They would come in and knock on their doors, and if they don't open, they would just spray all the house with bullets, and they would kill anybody that's in there. It's just ethnic cleansing there against Alawites in that area. And what we've been hearing right now is that there are military groups, but part of them are controlled by the new regime that's ruling Syria, and part of them are outsiders, either foreigners from other countries, or either just some people who happen to volunteer to come in and kill people in that area.
Do you have any idea of where these foreigners may have come from?
I don't really know, but it's being said that it's probably from Chechnya, Uyghurs or something like that. There are some of them in video, documented, with other accents, or speaking in languages that are not Arabic.
And so this is very frightening for your friends and family still in that region. Have you managed to contact them today?
I've managed to contact my family a few hours ago. Their words were only these three words: no electricity, water or connection, we're safe for now. And that's it. That's what I was able to get from them. There's no connection. Sometimes I try to call, like international calls or anything, and I barely get a connection. It's really hard.
Yeah, it sounds really difficult for you. When you were able to have more communication with them, do you know if it was their intent to stay put or to try to leave and escape, and where would they try to go?
Unfortunately, even if they try to go and leave anywhere, there's nowhere to go. Basically, there's a curfew right now and it's been going on for 2 days and it's on its way into the third. People are not allowed to leave their homes, even if they want to go anywhere. There's nowhere that's safe. My family live in a village, so if they wanted to go anywhere to be safe, they'd go into the farms or into the mountains, into the fields. But even in the fields or the farms, they're not safe because of the videos that have been documenting everything that's been happening. Those extremists have been following people and looking for them and searching everywhere and killing them. There are people being killed in their fields, in their farms. There are bodies lying in the streets. There are dead lying in the streets. Nobody was able to take these bodies and bury them because it's not safe. They cannot leave the house.
And those were the words of one woman who has family in that area. We voiced up her responses because she didn't want to be identified. Well, we've contacted the Syrian government to ask about the allegations made in that interview. We're yet to receive a response from them. The people of Greenland have got elections next week at a time when Donald Trump says he wants to take over the autonomous Danish territory. He hasn't actually ruled out using military force, arguing that the US needs the world's biggest island for Arctic security. And then there's the minerals of coarse and rare earth metals beneath the ice. But what's the view in Denmark about Mr. Trump's apparent desire to take, possibly even invade, Greenland? The US has been one of its closest military allies. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek travelled to the Danish capital, Copenhagen, to judge the mood.
Well, this is La Fontaine Jazz Club. It's the oldest in town. It's often described as the best jazz club on this side of the Atlantic. It's a little corner of America here in Copenhagen. And we've come to this place at a time where, once again, President Trump is saying he wants a not-so-little chunk of Denmark in the form of Greenland.
I find it really scary. Everything he sees, he just wants to get everything in some kind of way.
Music student Lucas is here with friends Molly and first Clara.
Mostly I get affected by this because I think Donald Trump is scary and because we know that he's so powerful, he can affect our everyday in a lot of different ways.
This is Denmark's memorial to its war dead from recent conflicts. And this section here focuses on the dozen years of conflict in Afghanistan. 43 Danish soldiers were killed in that campaign. And in a population of only 6 million people, proportionately speaking, that's the second highest rate of deaths, behind only the US.
I'm Søren Knudsen. I am a retired colonel of the Danish Army.
Yeah. My name is Gina Schaar. I'm married to Søren. I'm an American-Danish dual citizen.
I was awarded a Bronze Star by the United States, and I got the Stars and Stripes. They have been hanging on my wall in our house ever since, and I have proudly shown this to everybody. But after the president's disrespect for internationally acknowledged borders, after J.D. Vance's rambling on European values in Munich, I took that Stars and Stripes down.
I have always been very proud of my husband's service together with American-led missions, even though there has never been an attack on Danish soil. So it comes as a shock to hear threats from a country that I also love and to feel that that alliance is being trampled.
Here we are in our ops room, which is the big map we have on the very big screen on the wall. This is where we update on...
Hans-Tino Hansen runs Risk Intelligence. They give advice on threats around the world. President Trump claims U.S. control of Greenland is an absolute necessity for international security.
He cites the threat from the Chinese and the Russians. In that respect, has he got a fair point?
I would say that Denmark could have done more, but actually the main culprit here is the US, because they have removed all their icebreakers. The Russians have increased their presence in the Arctic, that's for sure, but it's not a presence that can directly threaten the US or kind of occupy Greenland, because we're talking about more than 2 million square kilometers.
Still, Denmark has said it will spend an extra $2 billion on defence, including in the Arctic. And Hans believes security there can be bolstered without an American takeover, but with deals that restore the scope of US influence.
You can say that if you make more agreements, both on defense security, but also maybe on the economic sense and raw materials, then we are more or less going back to where we were in the 50s and 60s.
If we look at this globe, Greenland is the most centrally located place on Earth.
So what to make of it all?
President Trump's declaration of intention to maybe take Greenland by force. It's very similar to President Putin's rhetoric when it comes to Ukraine.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen was Danish Prime Minister for most of the noughties, and then NATO Secretary General.
I don't think, at the end of the day, that the Americans will take Greenland by force. If they're concerned about security, they could just increase the military presence in Greenland, and we would all welcome that.
For him, ultimately, the Danes simply may not be able to do business here, with a man whose view on territorial integrity is so wildly different from theirs.
Maybe it's not about security, maybe it's not about minerals, maybe it's just a question of expanding the territory of the United States. And that's actually a point where we are not able to accommodate President Trump.
The BBC's Nick Beek there, reporting from Copenhagen in Denmark. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. Now, if you were listening to NewsHour earlier this week on World Obesity Day, you'll have heard us reporting the news that new research suggests that more than half of all adults and a third of all children will be obese by the year 2050. Obesity rates are rising rapidly all over the world, with potentially massive consequences for health systems, because, as we know, obesity is linked to cardiovascular disease, some cancers, also diabetes, among other things. So what can governments do to try to bring down the rates of obesity? Let's discuss this now. We're joined live by Dr. Christine Frey, Associate Professor in Dietetics and Nutrition at the College of Health and Sciences in Jamaica. And Jason Fung is with us. He's a Canadian nephrologist and author of the best-selling book, The Obesity Code and the Complete Guide to Fasting. Welcome both. Thank you for coming on. Christine, first of all, the Caribbean is one of the areas in the world that has shown up as having a particular problem with this, potentially in the future as well. Why is that?
Well, thank you so much. What we are finding is that in the Caribbean, with our obesity increasing, when we look at the diets, we are seeing that people are, especially for Jamaica, are frying their foods more. So when it comes on to, you know, meat preparation, you'll find that a lot of our foods are fried or have oil being added. And we find also that our consumption of fruits and vegetables, like for vegetables, it's less than 18% of Jamaicans who are actually eating fruits on a regular basis, and roughly 12%. Well, it's the other way around, 12% for fruits and less than 18% for vegetables. So the diet and physical activity is also low.
Right. So, and that's a change then, is it? Because, I mean, Caribbean food is delicious, but perhaps people are now eating more of the fried element of it and less of the sort of fresh fruit and veg, which has always been part of the diet, hasn't it?
Yes, and that is what is happening. So we have this perfect storm of, you know, low physical activity and then consuming foods that are higher in fat, also in sodium and sugar. So that is what we are seeing. And it is it has been a steady increase. Each time a survey of Jamaicans are done, surveys of other countries as well, we are seeing an increase in you know, in weight and adiposity throughout the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Jason Fung, let's bring you in there. Obviously, consumption is one of the main factors, isn't it? We're all eating too much. But as Christine mentioned there, low activity, sedentary lifestyle, is there anything else that's making us all fatter?
Well, I think we have to look at some of the changes in the sort of food supply and how we get our food sort of thing, because the thing is that there's been, I mean, for the last 50 years, there's been an increasing rate of obesity, in North America, of course, sort of led the way. And the problem is that there's always been this emphasis on individual responsibility and changing people's diets. But I think we also have to look at societal factors as well, because if you think about it, there, you know, if 50%, I mean, in North America, it's higher, of people are being obese, then it's not a simply an individual failing. It's something right. that's changed it's within our society, and that's what we have failing. To look at.
Yeah, so
well, exactly.
I mean, is there? I mentioned could governments legislate on this, which a lot of people don't want governments to be overly involved in things. But what could governments do that might make an impact?
Well, I think you have to look at the ultra-processed foods because whatever is happening to the sort of way that people eat worldwide, it has to be fairly big and fairly systemic. And ultra-processed foods really sort of is the only thing that fits the bill. You can't say that it's, you know, if you have, 100 million people who are affected in the United States, by obesity, it's not each and every single one of their fault. Obviously, it's not a low willpower problem or so on. It's probably due to the fact that ultra-processed foods are not natural. There's different ways that they cause obesity.
Mm.
I mean, we know that they're engineered for people to, you know, they're engineered to be addictive.
Right.
They're engineered to make people eat more to reduce satiety, right? Because if you eat more, they sell more, which means they make more money. So
okay.
they're not interested in selling you food that is going to be like that.
So that's a good
that's
point.
One of the big, that's one of the big things because it's starting to affect the rest of the world as well.
Yeah.
And ultra-processed foods are cheap, right? Because you're using chemicals to simulate real food.
Dr. Frey, is this something you've seen in the Caribbean and specifically Jamaica? Because I know that research did say that sort of middle-income countries were becoming more and more affected. Perhaps more affluence in Jamaica has led to more people eating out more often rather than cooking at home. Would you say that was the case?
Yes, we have seen that. And in terms of policies, as you had asked before, we have school nutrition policies that are being looked at now. So like for Jamaica, we are at the green paper stage where the public was actually invited last week to take a look. So we had a number of nutrition professionals, medical doctors, legal minds that got a look at that.
Mm.
And we have been looking at sugar sweetened beverages as well in terms of policies. So like even Barbados has already done its implementation of taxation on that. And Jamaica and Grenada are looking at that right now. So in terms of that, yes, we are seeing the governments for various countries, doing things to put things in place to protect us as well as our children.
I suppose, Dr. Fung, then it depends on the response from the food industry too, doesn't it? And it needs to be something that is kind of worldwide, not just in pockets briefly.
Well, absolutely, because you have to look at, like, where are the subsidies going? So if you look at subsidies, for example, for things that go into ultra-processed foods, like wheat, for example, it's much, much higher than any subsidies that go into fresh fruits or vegetables. So you look at these sort of policies, like certainly taxation is a way to influence policy, restricting advertising, for example. Mm. We did that in tobacco.
With smoking, yeah.
The Joe the Camel, which was targeted to children. Like, okay. But we target all kinds of cereals and snacks and certainly very unhealthy foods to children. So those sort of policy things need to be looked at.
Something to look at. Thank you so much to you both for joining us on that. No doubt we will return to this subject again. For the moment, though, Dr. Jason Fung and Dr. Christine Frey, thank you both for joining us.
Some AI-powered dating apps can predict who you might find attractive. Others help build your profile or suggest conversation starters. So are they the future of love, or are they just a bit creepy? I'm Hannah Gelbart. We're diving into how these apps work and how they differ from traditional dating apps. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We go in depth on a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.